Genesis 10. Please, Genesis 10. We start off with some true and false questions. We are in a section now, two chapters. A little part of this refers to the Tower of Babel, the historic event where Noah's sons and their descendants decided to gather instead of scatter. And the bigger picture is more about the scattering than it is about their, you know, effort to remain together. God sovereignly overruled their rebellious attempts. So there's some challenging lessons here. There's a lot of information in these two chapters, genealogies and other historical things. If you're into history, you'll want to do some more reading and digging here. But let's try to pull away the theology, the lesson. What did it seem was delivered to Israel? And at the time when they may have been, you know, in the wilderness getting ready to go into the promised land, what kind of equipping did God provide for them to bring them on their way? And how well did they follow? Let me get to the point here. Confidence, true or false, confidence in human achievement is our greatest security. Nobody jumped up and down on that one. True or false, God blesses those who are proud. I'm getting a pattern here. How about this one? Boy, and it's interesting how relevant these recent studies are to some current events. Nations, true or false, nations can bring about their own destiny. Okay, so you get my point. Big idea, I think, goes like this. The sovereign God restrains the evil of a united nation acting in rebellious pride. That's a little longer than big ideas are supposed to be by a couple of words, but I'll repeat it again. It's not a cheerful one, but it's the word, so we've got to learn from it, and we will. The sovereign God restrains the evil. He doesn't judge and wipe them out this time. He restrains them. Of a united nation acting in a rebellious pride. And we can be glad that he did restrain the evil, and God restrains evil. And I need about another week on these two chapters, but I'll give you what I have and trust the Lord will use it. Pride is the ultimate insecurity. Point number one. Pride is the ultimate insecurity. Number two, and I might change this when we get to it. Pride keeps us from God's blessing. Pride keeps us from God's blessing. Another way to look at that would be, having learned this, wait on the Lord for his blessing. And each of us individually and collectively can see ourselves doing that. We must wait on the Lord for his blessing. Chapter 11 is where I would kind of like to start, but I need to start in chapter 10, and I'll explain a little bit more why. Let's pray together before we get started into the text. Father, thank you for Genesis 10 and 11, and for the record of history and people and places that you provided for us. Thank you that you gave this to a people, the original readers, the nation of Israel, at some point. We think we know approximately when that was, and so we're grateful that we've been able to learn over the years how to understand your meaning to us, what your word means to us today is what it meant to the original readers in a general crossover of application can be gleaned. And so we ask you to help us to glean that today. Help me certainly to be able to communicate it in a meaningful way. May your people be edified, built up in the faith for the work of the ministry. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Let's start in 10. That's where the Bible does. Genesis 10 is a selective genealogy of Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. It is selective in that it's about sons and not daughters. It is selective in that it's about some of the sons, but not all of the sons. Let me get into it a little bit. Now these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and unto them were born sons after the flood. The sons of Japheth, Gomer and Magog and Madi and Javan and Tubal and Meshach and Tyrus. You can start to hear place names. And the sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz and Riphath and Togarmah. I'm not going to try real hard to get these right. And the sons of Javan, Elisha and Tarshish. Heard that before? Kittim and Dodanim. By these were the isles or the coasts of the Gentiles divided in their lands, everyone after his tongue, after their families, and after their nations. We just read a brief description of the descendants, of a selective descendant list of Japheth. We're about to switch over to Ham. That begins in verse 6. And then we would go to Shem in verse 21. Do you see that? At the end of each description is a summary. And we just read that summary, verse 5. By these, by Japheth's descendants, were the isles or the coast of the Gentiles divided in their lands, every one after his own tongue, after his families, after their nations. Wait a minute. When did languages begin? Multiple languages. Chapter 11. Why is it talking about tongues here? What you're going to find is the two chapters were not written in order chronologically, but more thematically. As a matter of fact, Babel happened kind of in the middle of chapter 10. There's a lot of fun in this genealogical study, and I would urge you to do some more reading and observing later. And if you want to read pages on this, get out is it Alan Ross's commentary? Boy, does he have a bunch of historical stuff that comes out. I'm going to show you a map in a few minutes that helps with a visual aid. Verse 6, and the sons of Ham, Cush and Mizraim, and I'm going to pronounce it Foot because I like it better. Canaan and the sons of Cush, Seba and Havilah and Sabta and Rama and Sabactuk and the sons of Rama, Sheba and Dedan, and Cush begat Nimrod. How many have used the word Nimrod as a joking name? You, Nimrod, right? That's an old nickname. That's an old name. Here's maybe where it originated. We don't know anybody in the Bible before Nimrod. And by the way, there's some things about him that are a little hard to understand, I think, in just a brief reading. But as you put it all together, it becomes clearer. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. Now, let's pause for a moment. Where's the last time we read about mighty ones? Men of renown. Genesis 6. I think there's an intentional comparison. Genesis 6, before the flood, there were men of renown who are gaining in popularity and status and power. Something going on here. And he was a mighty hunter in the Lord. Let me pause here, right here, and say I don't know much about this phrase, but when you connect it with the other phrases, I don't think it's because he had the biggest buck every year. I think there's something else going on with him being called the mighty hunter. These people had to hunt for food, and they were not, you know, I don't think this is about, you know, who got the biggest buck award in Genesis 10. There's something else going on here. And here's how we gather that. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. And again, before the Lord, you know, you could look at that and say, oh, that's great. He honored the Lord. He walked with the Lord. But in a few verses, we're going to see the Lord came down to see the errors of men. And I think it's more along the lines of before the Lord in the sense of God was watching him because he was not living right. Just hold that thought if you need to. Wherefore it is said, even of Nimrod, the mighty hunter, before the Lord, and the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Who was the ringleader of establishing this tower city security in our we can control our destiny? Nimrod. Not only Babel, these other cities, and Erech and Akkad and Calna and the land of Shinar. Out of that went forth Asher, who builded Nineveh. Remember Nineveh? What kind of a city did that become? Not a tourist attraction. So, briefly, I'm not going to read the rest of Ham's descendants, but let's read the summary in verse 20. Canaan was in there, of course. The Canaanites. These are the sons of Ham after their families, after their tongues, and in their countries, and in their nations. So this division of families and tongues and countries and nations now divided the descendants of the three brothers of, three sons of Noah. Let me point out before I read a little further, Ross in his commentary summarizes that this is more than a genealogy. He says, and appropriately so, I'm just quoting him because he has all the components there. It's easier to quote him than it is to try to remember it myself. The chapter includes famous people, well-known cities and places, tribes and nations, as well as a number of names that could have been individuals at the time but became known later as peoples. There's a lot here. Unto Shem, verse 21, also the father of all the children of Eber, a well-known individual, apparently Eber was a famous individual because he comes down a little bit later. The brother of Japheth, the elder, even to him were children born. The children of Shem, Elam and Asher and Arphaxad and Lud and Aram, and the children of Aram, Uz and Hul and Gether and Mash, and Arphaxad begat Salah, and Salah begat Eber, and Eber were born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days was the earth divided. What's happening here? So it's interesting to think about. In his days was the earth divided. We don't have to go outside of this chapter to understand the division. There were three brothers. They got off an ark with their folks. They had descendants. And they attempted this project to unite themselves in chapter 11. And God dispersed them with languages. We're reading about that dispersion in this chapter. Three divisions. It seems strongly that it's simply referring to this national division based on the descendants that God caused by creating languages. Division of the nation that was there. So looking at this genealogy, the days of Peleg were about 100 years after the flood. We'll see that later, where that comes from. So in only 100 years' time, this rise of evil again and pride again and independence from God again. In the past, I've preached this to Yankees, being one. My grandpa fought in one of the world wars, and he's known in writing an article in the newspaper, and he said, and, you know, he described some interaction, rifles and others and so on. He says, and the Yankees gave it right back. So we sometimes have too much Yankee independence to be the spiritual people God wants us to be. And to live independently from our Creator, to live independently from His program, the local church and its gatherings. We're not tuned in as much as we should be. We're not making way for us to be with God's people and God's program. And that Yankee independence that's there is helpful in certain parts of our day and our week. But when it keeps us from God's program because this is who we are, this passage kind of shouts at us a little bit. And it says, be humble, not proud. During Peleg's time is when Babel happened. During Nimrod's time is when Babel happened. Does that make sense? Babel happened during Nimrod's time, third generation, I think, from Noah. Peleg was five generations. So Nimrod had some time to get this thing going before actually Babel actually happened and God confounded the languages. conclusion in the chapter, verse 31, these are the sons of Shem, after their families, after their tongues, after their lands, after their nations. Again, the same concepts. These are the families of the sons of Noah, after their generations, in their nations, and by these were the nations divided in the earth after the flood. There are handy maps online, and I happen to get this from my Bible study software. I don't know how to make that brighter. But if you can see that and get oriented to that, you can see the Mediterranean Sea and the Red Sea. So here is Egypt. Thank you. The Promised Land here. You know, Ham, as we described, and apparently in history they can also find these various sons of Ham that and where they lived along the coasts and Japheth. You can barely read it up here in. We call it Turkey now. Many of the churches in the Apostle Paul's missionary travels, Ephesus and Corinth, and many of those churches are up here. Shem is over here in what is now Iraq and Iran. Notice Babel. By the way, where did these three sons come from? The mountains of Ararat are in eastern Turkey, right next to the border of Armenia, way up here. So they came out of there and came down to this area and builded this city, or got started on it, and it was there that we go to next. So this helps us to see a little bit what took place in chapter 10. When we get to chapter 11, we begin to see the thinking and the context of what they were thinking and then what God was thinking. I'd like to point out the two main themes here this way. There's the depravity of man is just taking place. It's just boiling out of what's going on here. And then we also see the sovereignty of God. God's rule above and beyond, unthreatened in any way, accomplishing all his will and desire. Verse 1 and 11, the whole earth was of one language. Now, quickly you can say, okay, chronology here. In relation to chapter 10. And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech, and it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said one to another, go to, let us make brick, and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and slime they had for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build a city. Let's build brick, let's build a city and a tower, whose top may reach unto heaven. And let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. Let me give you a quick reference, chapter 9 and verse 1. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the what? The earth. So, and it's mentioned again a couple of other places, verse 7. And be you fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply therein. Verse 19, these are the three sons of, this is a historical account rather than a command right here. These are the three sons of Noah, and of them was the whole earth overspread. Well, that was God's design for them to overspread the earth, not remain in one area, certainly not with the attitude and the objectives that they had. Build brick. Build a city, make a name. The tower that reaches to heaven, there's a spiritual component to this of some kind that shouts of idolatry, but anything except trust and faith and walk with God. So their objectives were, let's keep the unity, let's keep ourselves from being scattered, direct opposition to God's design and command. And there's this, make us a name. What's that? What is that all about? This prestigious, construction project, and boy, we're going to be known for this. And are they? It's all independent and opposed to God's command. Their insecurity, they were insecure, lest we be scattered. They were fearful. We're going to be scattered. We don't want to be scattered. How can we prevent being scattered? We have to build a city and a name, and that'll keep us together. We can control our own destiny. Disregard of God. So they attempted to build their own security in brick, city with tower, and prestigious reputation. What did they wind up with? An unfinished city, an unfinished tower, so it seems. And a reputation with the word that sounds like babble instead of anything meaningful and intellectual. I guess I'm not here to pick on them, but to learn from them. Again, the challenge for us is to recognize the tendency we have even in our own hearts, that old nature that that God didn't take away when we got saved. And so we struggle with that old nature. Aren't you glad someday the Lord is going to take us home and that nature's staying behind? It's not going with us. Won't that be the day? Among all the other blessings of becoming present in heaven with Christ. Look at a couple of references. Genesis 8:21. I want to talk about depravity just a little and get us to think about it because of the relevance of our life and our day and things that we see in our world today and in our own lives. Genesis 8:21, God makes this statement after the sacrifice that Noah made after the flood. And the Lord smelled a sweet savor, and the Lord said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground anymore for man's sake. And here's why. For the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. So what I think part of what God is saying is he's going to be even more patient than he was now going forward than he was with those before the flood. And the long suffering, it's the long suffering of God that is keeping his rapture and the kingdom from coming to earth, even still, while evil is prevailing in so many ways. Ephesians chapter 2 is a passage that talks about we were dead in trespasses and sins, and we followed the way of the world, and the prince of the power of the air was, we just walked in that way, this deadness and this depravity of man, this inclination to do evil without regard for God. Look with me, though, at Jeremiah 17, please. Jeremiah 17:9. When we talk about these things, as it relates to our propensity to sin, we must come to the question, how is this taken care of? How is this resolved? How can I get help from this in my own heart, in my own life? This propensity to sin. Got it? Jeremiah 17:9. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? When you can't figure out how corrupt people can be, this verse answers, stop trying to figure it out because you can't figure it out. But it also refers to our heart as that unsaved part of us, that old nature, when we're not surrendered to Christ, living in our own way, the heart is deceitful, Jeremiah 17:9. Above all things and desperately wicked, who can know it? You know, when a person comes to recognize their depravity, their inclination to sin, and their total inability to do anything that pleases God and it satisfies Him, they just cannot be done. Another verse here, not too far from this passage, says that all our righteousnesses are as filthy rags to God. My understanding is a lot of people think they're going to be able to offer some deal to God, some appeasement, some effort, some, you know, community work, some tithing, some other religious activities. They're going to be able to hopefully package that up, and or God's already going to be aware of it, and He'll see it, and He'll say, okay, yeah, okay, I know you're a sinner, but okay, yeah, you can go in. You can be saved. You can go to heaven. The Bible teaches that that is not the case. When it says all our righteousnesses are as filthy rags, that means all the good things that we've done in and of our own strength, God just sees them as trash. And that may be startling or shocking, but it's reality, and it's a good thing to know it now before then. Because now you can be saved. Now you can confess Jesus is the only way for us to be saved. He is the only one that can forgive us and provide forgiveness for your sins and mine. You cannot be good enough for God. Nobody can be good enough. You're in the group with all the rest of us. None of us could be good enough for God. That's why we trust Jesus. That's why we urge you to trust Jesus for forgiveness of sins. These people, Shem, Ham, Japheth, and their sons, back in Genesis, were trusting their own efforts not to be good for God, but to be independent of God. They had this insecurity, lest we be scattered. They wanted to remain together. And I'd like to focus on that just for a few minutes. Because there are securities and there are insecurities, and their biggest insecurity was their pride. I don't want to overthink this too much, but I'd like to share some things with you a little bit. I think it's normal to have certain things for securities, and we're going to talk about a bunch of them. I think it's normal to have these and to kind of expect them and you kind of miss them when you don't have them. But then we know, too, that there's the ultimate security, the foundation of our life security and our eternal security is with God and His Word, His promises, right? There's a big difference. True stabilizing security comes from God, from His Word. We know that. Charity sang a song this morning. What was the treasures of trials? Did you catch that? I don't think I remember hearing that before. That was special. The treasures of trials. Okay. That's a biblical concept. There are treasures and benefits to the trials we go through. And it's because of promises and principles in Scripture like that that help us to weather these challenges. But let's talk about securities. It's easier to talk about securities that other people have than our own. So we'll start with them. Babies. We think that babies get security from a pacifier, and they get a little older, a sippy cup and a blanket. Right? We have to kind of get them out of the sippy cup phase at some point. Anybody struggle with that? With, you know, we have to kind of, I'm seeing a few smiles. Youth, young people, securities, acceptance, generally speaking, is helpful. For young people, probably all of us. Friends that are sort of constant. Parents that are predictable and dependable. We think the same about young people, right? How about adults? What are our securities? What do I have here? Sippy cup. Only we call ours a travel mug and there's coffee in it. Tell me if I'm wrong on that. Friends who care. Parents who are well, children who are close, steady work, government leaders who fear God and love the truth. Well, seniors. Do seniors need security? Social security. I didn't write that one in, but it just came to mind. Sufficient income. Seniors pray for wellness a lot for their family and themselves. A well-sanded driveway gives them security. And a few other things. We know when you don't have some of these things, it kind of hurts. Sometimes you might live without some of them for quite a while. Wealth or certain relationships or health, I mean. But how is your security? Do you have the true spiritual security and a relationship with God through faith in Jesus Christ? Is your hope in God? We could ask ourselves that every day as Christians. Isn't that what the psalm writer said in Psalm 40 and 41? Why art thou disquieted, O my soul, and why art... there's another phrase in there. Why art thou disquieted within me? Hope thou in God. If you remember the concept there that someone explained, he stopped listening to himself and he started talking to himself. You, hope in God. There's a difference. We listen to ourselves and we get discouraged and we get downhearted and we think this is bad and that's coming apart and this isn't working and I'll never have this, and we can just go on and on listening to ourselves. And we do. But probably more often than we do, we should come back and start talking to ourselves. And if it helps, to point yourself in the face with your finger and say, you hope in God. Stand in the mirror and do that. Tell me what your wife says later. Does your God keep you when these temporal securities fail you? He does. But do we trust in him and rest in him? That's the key. The depravity of man is there at Babel. And then we see the sovereignty of, and yet we being saved and wanting to live in a way that pleases the Lord, recognize there is a security that we can have, and it's in him. Notice with me the sovereignty of God in chapter 11, verse 5. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, there's a pattern that's repeated here that was also is also in chapter 6. The Lord saw, the Lord said, and the Lord performed. He took action against the evil back then. He's going to do the same here. He says in verse 6, God says in verse 6, behold, the people is one, and they have all one language, and this they begin to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. Notice here, God is not just looking at this building and this tower and this name. He's looking at what they could wind up doing and what they would develop in doing further and further down the road. And he stopped it. Go to, let us go down. Why would God say, let us go down? The Trinity. And there confound, thank you, Reed, and there confound their language that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city, just like that. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did there confound, it's God's name, this gibberish name almost, it was put on this city, on this project, because of the confounding of the language. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did there confound the language of the earth, and from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad in the face of the earth. God scattered them. One people, one language, they're just beginning, God says. There's no limit to the boundary or restraint what they will do. So God restrained them with, if you will, punishment to preserve. He did not wipe them out like he did with the flood, but to preserve. Here we see the principle of pride again that God is dealing with. God is judging this united nation that had to be divided with pride. You remember the verse in Proverbs 16 that says, pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. You ever experienced that? If we were all humble enough, we'd all raise our hands, right? And then if we were proud about it, we'd raise two hands. What happens? You know, we get proud. You better look out, because something's coming where it's not going to be good. And you can watch it in other people's lives where there's pride exerted and evidenced, and they just relate to people with pride, and on it goes. You could see it at work. You could see it in churches. You can see it in various homes and families. It's a principle of life established by God in his word. When we grow in pride, who was the first to do that? Satan, Lucifer, wanted to be like the Most High God, and he met his fall in one stage out of heaven and is going to meet another fall coming up. It's important for us to recognize and be humble and really grow in this. Be more humble than you think is possible. It's probably a good way to think about it. Be more humble than you think is possible, because we have more work to do in that area. James 4, 6 and 1 Peter 5, 5 say, God resisteth the proud. And boy, did he do that here. he resisteth the pride. Israel as a nation, if we want to think about how they might have received this, would have seen, oh, they sought nationality and prestige and a name for themselves, and it didn't go well because they did it independent of God. Israel would have done well to learn that same thing, and so would we today. May I say this? Be discerning when you hear declarations of faith in man who are opposing God. Pride is the ultimate insecurity. Secondly, pride keeps us from God's blessing. And another way to look at this is we simply need to wait. There are times when we need to wait, and this is one of those times. Wait on God's blessing. This other genealogy begins in verse 10, chapter 11 and verse 10. This is a linear genealogy of Shem. The genealogy in chapter 10 would go down, and then a couple of sons, and it go down more, and then there's a number of sons, and one of the sons had 13 sons. So, boom, and it kind of stops at Peleg. Here, it's father, son, father, son, father, son, father, son, all the way to who? Abram. Some neat observations, can I share them with you? First of all, it leads us to Abram. It leads us to Abraham, this genealogy does. I don't want to say a lot about that because we'll get there, Lord willing, next week. There's five generations from Noah to this Peleg, and it's in this record you can find that was about 100 years from the flood. That's all. Another thing that we see is that, if you look with me at verse 10, these are the generations of Shem. Shem was 100 years old and begat Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. What do we have here? We have his age, which is interesting to go back and look at and think about. There's some neat things to observe there. I won't take the time now. Arphaxad was born 2 years after the flood. Now we can add that to other numbers in the list and come up with the time of years, the number of years between the flood and Abraham. Let me show you what I did. It's simple enough to do. And Shem lived after he begat Arphaxad 500 years and begat sons and daughters. And Arphaxad lived 530 years and begat Selah. Take 2, add it to 35, the birth of this particular son. This is a very intentional lineal genealogy. Anyways, you add up the years that are there at the birth of the next son, and you come up with 297 years from the flood to Abram. That's not a lot of time. I found it interesting to think about, and you can do this with a little more time at home. What's interesting, too, is the lifespan suddenly goes down. Shem lived 600 years. He was 100. He had a son. He lived 500 years more. He lived 600 years. You work down through that, and it gets shorter and shorter and shorter until Terah, Abram's father, was 148, is all he had. So the lifespan is shortening. Here's another one. Shem, if my math is right and my observations are correct, was about 300 when Abram was born. 400. Was about 400 when Abram was born. He was contemporary with Abram. So my question to you is, Joshua, did Shem outlive Abraham? You can find that later. Not now, but you can find that later. There's genealogy. What does it lead to? I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but let me share the observation. Alan Ross in particular pointed this out. There is a change of pattern in this passage. We are in a big transitional point in Genesis. We learned about creation, the fall of man, the flood, Babel. We're now going to begin to look at the patriarchs and the time given to each of them. The next four is lengthy in their life, in their faith, in their walk with God, and in their being blessed by God, which is the big subject that is missing in chapters 10 and 11, the blessing of God. Let me try to explain. The scattering of nations because of rebellious pride took place, and there's no mention of blessing. Think of it. And again, I appreciate Ross's observing this and pointing it out. I'm simply trying to convey it, this concept that's here in the text with you, or not in the text here. Adam and Eve, when they took of the fruit and they ate of the fruit, they suffered a curse and were provided clothing and restoration to God, a blessing. There was judgment and blessing. When Cain killed his brother, he was cursed for his sin, and life was going to be so much harder for him, and he was going to be estranged from everybody, and he was concerned that he would die, and God graciously, not only one thing, gave him a second chance before that, but also then put a mark on him to protect him. Judgment, blessing. How about the flood? The wickedness of man prevailed, and God sent a flood, and he judged the earth, and he wiped men off the face of the earth. But there was this ark that maintained life of people and animals, and there was a rainbow. And every time the rainbow happens, God looks at that rainbow and is reminded of his promise, thinks of his promise to not flood the earth again and destroy it. Here, the united people, proud as they were scattered from each other from God. The judgment took place, and there's no blessing. It's hard to know how to end a message with that. I thought of ending it right there. Where's the blessing? God has a blessing for his people, and it is about to be announced in a big way. So for you and I, perhaps, to recognize more and more the humility we need to display before our great God, to grow in finding your life security in God and in his promises. That's a lifelong maturity, isn't it? Don't place your security in your own accomplishments. Don't seek accomplishments that provide, don't take this the wrong way, enjoyment and fulfillment are part of life given to us by God. But don't make your pursuits all about accomplishments where your security can be placed in them instead of God. Great career, great accomplishments in other areas. Be humble and enjoy God's blessing day by day.